guys, thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to support us, please go to patreon.com/FrightDay.
Fred Trump.
Fred.
He had a weird mustache. He looks like the Monopoly Man.
I could see Monopoly Man from that. I could totally see Monopoly Man.
It's like if Anton LaVey was on the Monopoly board.
That is kind of what he looks like.
Yeah, he sold the souls.
It is Fright Day. I'm your under-the-weather host, Byron. In the aftermath of a... Let's get rid of that. In the aftermath of a catastrophic event, we find ourselves in a world where silence is survival, and family means everything. Tonight, we're reviewing John Krasinski's dynamic genre debut, A Quiet Place. A place where if you probably sneezed or coughed, it would not be good. And 1897 was a year of a lot of firsts. The first submarine with an internal combustion engine was demonstrated. The first car dealership opened in London. And the very first modern UFO was seen and photographed. This is the first experience of cattle mutilation.
The first crash.
And a real-life alien corpse?
Yes, sir.
It's UFO sightings that started it all in this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies. I'm joined tonight by Kelly.
Hi, guys.
And Sam.
Hey, guys.
Felt weird saying tonight since it's light outside and it's also 3 p.m.
Yeah, but it should be tonight for you because as soon as we're done with this, you need to go to bed, Byron.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate it. Not doing great.
No, I'm sorry.
But that's okay. Maybe I'll get a chance to watch a couple things halfway in bed.
Maybe you'll actually watch them since you'll be in bed. This could be a great thing, Byron.
Hey, I watched a couple things this week.
Did you watch or did you Byron watch?
I watch.
Hey, now.
You know.
I mean, it's a thing. It's actually a patented branded thing now.
Yeah, you half watch something. Yeah, pick up minor details and then misinterpret them.
Yes, most importantly. That's the key element.
You guys know I have a soft spot for mumble gore / mumble horror films.
Yes, I do know this.
And I thought that I knew everything. But after doing some digging, I realized how ridiculous that is. Because this week I went to Wikipedia, what they deemed the beginning of the genre, Ty West's 2005 debut, The Roost.
All this precaution makes me dizzy. If you ask me, folks, there's nothing better to cap off a spooky evening than a great Halloween night storm.
Ooh, how was it?
Well, before I tell you how it was, I want to tell you what it's all about.
All right, that's fine, I suppose.
Traveling to a Halloween wedding, four friends lucky to be alive after crashing their car find themselves stranded in the Pennsylvania countryside. The group sets off in search for help, only to discover that making it to the wedding on time is the least of their problems. They discover a nearby farm. The friends have no way to prepare for the roost of lurking bats in a barn and zombies in a house.
That sounds good.
It's surprisingly good, actually.
I was being serious.
I don't think you were.
No, he loves Ty West a lot. He probably was being serious.
And everything you said sounds amazing.
I really enjoy how Ty West in this movie, spoiler alert, the bats, they bite you and you turn into zombies instead of...
That's a very interesting vector.
Vampires, you know? Not necessarily following the genre structure that was introduced in the past. But yeah, it really surprisingly fun. It still feels kind of like a B-movie, but part of that could be because the intro is actually set up kind of like a horror host introducing programming, and it rolls into the film, so.
Ah, you're early. But welcome to Channel 13's special Saturday Night Frightmare Theater. I'm more than thrilled to have you here for such a truly wretched feature, indeed. In tonight's ghastly account, we're hot on the entrails of four young companions on their way to a wedding. And what could be more pleasant and serene than that, you ask? Well, I wouldn't know. Because let me tell you, Fright fans, we here at the mansion don't care for such pleasantries. And it won't be long before the wedding bells they so wish for have turned to Let us just say to that of a very different sort. But now I won't let the bat out of the bag just yet. So sit back and enjoy. Delve into your deepest and darkest indulgences as we proudly present tonight's creature's feature, The Roost.
An interesting early meta horror take and a really cool debut. I had never heard of this movie. You guys should all check it out, no matter if you're a mumble horror, mumble gore kind of person or not, because I think this is a great entry point. It was also shot in 16mm, which is kind
of cool.
You keep smelling your hair, huh?
Yeah. Do you think that Aveda would be a sponsor for us?
Absolutely.
I really like their shampoo.
I'm going to dump this coffee in my lap.
But it's kind of expensive. I mean, it's worth it. It smells good. But if we could get some free shampoo, that'd be great. Well, you think you could contact them? I'll talk about it every episode.
I'll lie about
That's why I keep smelling my armpits, because they smell good.
Well, and because today's show is brought to you by Speed Stick.
Sam doesn't use Speed Stick.
Or it should be.
I know.
I'm trying to get Sam to actually use native deodorant because I'm really worried about him getting Alzheimer's.
Well, yeah, because of the level of aluminum in the...
Right.
Yeah, it's not good for you.
It's not good.
You know what is good also about this movie I forgot to mention? It's a Glass Eye Picks, and it has a Larry Fess. Yeah, Ty and Fess have worked together for a very long time. Super cool.
Ties with Fess run deep. Ties.
I will not allow that.
All right. Well,
I thought that was really good.
A guy named Mr. Move wrote a song called I Raise Hell that plays during the credits of this movie. On the grave, I'm the murderer you heard about. Stories from the fire. A little peace and quiet is all I desire. But not until these kids are gone. Oh, y'all be dead by dawn. I'm not a real kill. I'm trying to find my way home. I raise hell. Which I think is a tradition that has kind of gone away recently. You know, credit music that's written specifically for a movie. It needs to happen more.
Vanilla Ice for the movie Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Ninja Turtles, exactly.
Okay, no.
Because Go Ninja.
Sufjan.
Okay, and Call Me My
Go, name. Go Ninja, Go Ninja, Go.
Exactly.
God, I forgot. He really did do that song, didn't he?
Sufjan?
No, I was thinking Vanilla, but that's okay.
Yeah.
You know what I like better than vanilla? Almond flavoring. It's way better.
I mean, yeah. I don't know why people eat sugar cookies with that vanilla flavoring.
Right, it should be almond.
Almond flavor.
Yeah, it's the best flavoring.
My mom does it all the time.
Yeah, your mom's a smart lady.
A weird show so far.
We do have a weird show. Almond flavoring and Aveda shampoo. Those are Kelly's recommendations of the week.
Okay, well, also, I should mention, I wanted to talk about this for a while, but I forgot entirely because on my flight home from Austin, Texas at South by Southwest, I finally watched The Beguiled.
Miss Martha! Miss Martha!
Is he dead?
No, get him inside.
Quick!
You're a most unwelcome visitor, and we do not propose to entertain you.
You'll find them easily amused.
You won't be here long enough for that.
How did you end up in this place?
Why are you so interested in me?
I admire your strength.
I'm just trying to give them what they need to survive in these times.
If you could have anything in the world, what would it be?
To be taken far away from here.
Come with me.
He seems to be a sensitive person.
Does he?
Nina?
John.
It seems the enemy is not what we believe.
I hope you like apple pie.
Is that my recipe?
It is.
I need rags. I need chloroform. Go to the smokehouse. Get the saw. Now. Bring me the anatomy book.
Can I get you anything?
Give me the key.
You know I'd get in trouble for that.
Is that Sofia Coppola.
Nicole Kidman.
What is it? Set in 1864, which is kind of close to when we're...
Right, yeah. It is.
Uh-huh. Really interesting
film. 30 years.
Incredible performance from everyone. Colin Farrell, he does some acting in this movie.
Did they play slightly less creepy individuals than they did in Killing of a Sacred Deer?
Differently creepy.
Ooh.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting traditional religious elements. Also, things go off the rail in this in a very interesting way, especially for such a period drama.
Do you think it counts as horror?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it gets dark and really interesting. Also, I mean, anything with Kirsten Dunst, of course. Elle Fanning is
she's so great.
Amazing in this movie. Sofia Coppola's ex-husband's band Phoenix does the music. Also, it takes place in the South in this big old colonial building. And for years, I've said that that would be my end goal, would be to have an old colonial.
It's weird.
Listen to the cicadas? Is that what they have?
Oh, they
there?
Do have cicadas.
Yeah.
Sure do.
That's an interesting thing in this movie, too. The background, I don't know if it was the mix in the plane or not, but it's just like cranked up with sounds of outside, you know, lots of
the ambient stuff.
It's yeah.
It's just really beating you in the face.
It was front and center. Yeah, check it out. You guys watch anything this week?
No, I'm actually trying to remember.
Nothing relevant to what we do here.
I don't believe so.
Well, tell me what is unrelevant. Unrelevant? Irrelevant.
Really excited because we're going to go see The Death of Stalin tonight.
Wait, what is that?
Okay, have you ever seen In the Loop?
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's like the funniest movie ever made. Same guy that directs Veep. His new movie is called The Death of Stalin and it has Buscemi in it.
I did see a still from that, actually. I haven't seen the trailer.
Jeffrey Tambor, what's his name from Cure for Wellness, the doctor. Can never remember his name. It's like Isaac, but I always want to call him Oscar Isaac, but it's not Oscar Isaac. You know what I'm talking about?
I have no idea who you're talking
about. The doctor
about.
From A Cure for Wellness.
No, you might have to look it up.
I mean, you could use it. There's a computer right in front of you.
I know. I just have so many pages open from my research.
Well, and while you're talking about some non-horror, I just want to maybe push a show on this platform of ours because I'm concerned that if no one watches it, that it'll get canceled. Also, it's relevant because it stars someone that Kelly is very interested in. AP Bio on NBC.
Oh, yeah.
It seems on the surface like a dumb comedy, but I am obsessed with this show. It stars Glenn Howerton.
Oh, fantastic.
Who's Dennis from It's
Dennis.
Always Sunny.
Just say it's got Dennis from Always Sunny. Nobody knows who Glenn Howerton is.
Well, Glenn would prefer I think people would know his name. Yeah. It's also written by a guy named Mike O'Brien, who I've been following for a long time. He was the head writer at SNL for a long time.
That's
but
awesome.
He had this show called 7 Minutes in Heaven where... 7 Minutes in Heaven. Oh, yeah. It was a show on YouTube.
Oh.
He'd interview actors in a closet and then try to kiss them at the end of it. And it was
always really
funny. This show is incredible. It's about a disgraced Harvard philosophy scholar who goes back to his hometown in Toledo, Ohio, to work at a high school.
Oh, wow.
As an AP bio teacher. But he doesn't want to teach. He wants to basically get back at this guy who got his job at Harvard. So he tries to get his students to help him. And he ends up maybe teaching them a little bit along the way. So watch this show. Please don't let it get canceled. I need another season.
I'll watch it.
Cool.
Also, the guy's name is Jason Isaacs.
I just realized I did watch something.
What did you watch?
I watched like the first 5 episodes of Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's really dumb fun.
It really is. I haven't finished the second season yet, but I can say that I think the blend of practical and digital in that show is probably about as good as it gets.
For a serialized.
Yeah.
The only other TV show that I can think of seeing Bruce Campbell in is that awful Burn Notice show on USA.
My name is Michael Weston. I used to be a spy until...
We got a Burn Notice on you.
Okay.
And they just... I mean... It's just night and day. At least I could tell in the 5 minutes that I spent watching that train wreck versus watching, you know, a few episodes of Ash vs. Evil Dead. You can actually tell that Bruce Campbell loves what he's doing in Ash vs. Evil Dead and was just getting a paycheck in that piece of garbage.
Well,
Burn Notice.
I mean, traditionally, our stance on USA television programming has been pretty high, right?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, all the great programs that are not exactly the same show, just with a different name.
Yeah, I would go out of my way. I would swerve off the road to run USA over.
Other than Mr. Robot.
Mr. Robot, but hopefully Mr. Robot would fly out of the carnage and land at a different network after I swerved into him.
Elliot knows.
I just want more Mr. Robot.
Well, it's coming. It's not soon. In any risk.
I know, I just need more now. All right. So good.
Westworld's coming back.
That's really soon. That's like a couple weeks, isn't it?
Yeah, less than 3.
Yeah.
It's funny, once that show comes out, it becomes the only thing we talk about on this podcast. So yeah. I think we should probably prepare people or start another podcast that's bonus for Patreon where I guess we only talk about Westworld.
Well, keep in mind, I will talk about other things in my reports. Good. So great. You'll be all right, guys. Moon month's coming. Woo!
Oh my God.
It's coming so soon.
Well, that's upsetting.
Should we go old-timey?
Yeah, cue the music. Oh, I got my top hat. It was all folded up in like a pork pie hat. Now it's a top hat. It's on top of my head.
I am building things out of copper and leather.
Okay, that's great. Uh-oh, you've got the black lung.
And I have a monocle as well.
It's...
Yeah.
It's what?
The mystery airships of 1896 and the UFO crash at Aurora in 1897.
In this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies.
Tonight's investigation started in an interesting way for me. I decided I was going to report on the 1897 UFO crash at Aurora, Texas, which is a pretty cool thing, guys. And we're going to start the episode by reading a newspaper clip from that sighting. But I'll give you a little preview of the rest of the evening's report, because as I started to write about this incident, I realized that the only way you can actually view this correctly is in the context of what had been going on for the previous 2 years. And I soon came to learn that those people from the 1890s in those real uncomfortable dresses and fun bathing suits were looking up to the skies and seeing some pretty cool stuff. All right, here's the title of the article. A windmill demolishes it. This is April 17th, 1897, Aurora, Texas.
I'm going to flip the old-timey switch.
Cool.
About 6 o'clock this morning, the early risers of Aurora were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship which has been sailing through the country. It was traveling due north and much nearer the earth than ever before. Evidently, some of the machinery was out of order, for it was making a speed of only 10 or 12 miles an hour and gradually setting toward the earth. It sailed directly over the public square, and when it reached the north part of town, collided with the tower of Judge Proctor's windmill and went to pieces with a terrific explosion, scattering debris over several acres of ground, wrecking the windmill and water tank, and destroying the judge's flower garden.
Old man Proctor's gonna be so pissed!
Gosh. The pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board, and while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. Mr. T.J. Weems, the U.S. Signal Service officer at this place and authority on astronomy, gives it as his opinion that he was a native of the planet Mars.
An expert in the field of astrometry.
Papers found on his person, evidently the record of his travels, are written in some known hieroglyphics and cannot be deciphered.
But they're written on paper.
Paper, huh?
The ship was too badly wrecked as to form any conclusion about its construction or motive power. It was built of unknown metal resembling somewhat a mixture of aluminum and silver, and it must have weighed several tons. The town is full of people today who are viewing the wreck and gathering specimens of the strange metal from the debris. The pilot's funeral will take place at noon tomorrow. S.E. Hayden.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that was a real newspaper article. This was about 20 miles northwest of Fort Worth.
So S.E. Hayden, was he trying to be funny? Going from the judge's flower garden being destroyed to the badly disfigured body
of a
pilot?
Well, I don't think so. I think that literally, I mean,
it's just... took it in stride back then.
It's just a small town, and so I think he was really trying to just give a description of where it was.
Right.
This object was cigar-shaped, which is interesting to note. As I started digging into the sightings from 1896, some of those sightings sound exactly like a Zeppelin, and others sound very much like a cigar-shaped UFO, which we've heard of before,
sure.
Right?
I don't think we've ever really covered one on the show, though.
No, we haven't talked about that specific brand of UFO, but this seems to be the earliest record I have found of any significant sightings. I will tell you guys that we are not going to ignore the fact that there was a body recovered from that crash, and that is, in my opinion, the most interesting part of this whole story. But we're going to rewind a little bit to give context for the sightings, because as we heard in this newspaper article, he said very specifically they were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship, which has been sailing through the country. Word had traveled. Things had been going on. We're going to rewind November 17th of the year before, so we're 1896, Sacramento, California. There was a large airship seen by hundreds of people. It was moving against the prevailing wind. Multiple reports said that. There was apparently a small cabin or cockpit attached. And the most detailed report of the evening came from a gentleman named R.L. Lowry, who was a former street railway employee. And he said he heard a voice from above call,
"Throw her up higher, she'll hit the steeple."
When he was looking up, he saw two men seated on a bicycle-like frame pedaling. Above them was a cigar-shaped body of the same length. So essentially, we're talking about a cylindrical tube.
Uh-huh.
And
kind of like an air submarine.
Yeah, like long, skinny.
What would you call that? Because submarine. Underwater.
And also from Lowry.
The thing had wheels at the side, like wheels on Fulton's old steamboat.
Sam, you want to tell us what Fulton's steamboat was?
Fulton's steamboat was a steamboat that had a big paddle wheel on it.
Yeah, so the paddle wheels on the side, essentially, that propelled it.
Side wheeler.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Now, November 20th, a couple days later, it shows up over Sacramento again, but then went down to San Francisco about 90 miles south. And some claim they saw more than just one light, that there were actually three lights. Common theme with these sightings, they're happening at night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll get a little more into why that might be the case. Down by San Francisco, it was observed by hundreds, if not thousands, including the mayor. It cruised as far as the Pacific Ocean, above the famous Cliff House, where its searchlight, a beam that stretched out over 500 feet, reportedly frightened the poor seals sitting on Seal Rock, and they all jumped into the safety of the sea. Poor little seals. A couple weeks later, early December, small town north of San Francisco, apparently the ship lands on a beach with three crew members. This is another newspaper report from the time, guys. These three crew members carried the ship into the woods, and some fishermen approached the boat but were confronted by a captain.
No.
Again, described a cigar shape, 20 feet long, with wings that fold up against the fuselage.
This was the captain?
Sorry, this was the shape of the vessel. The captain told the fishermen that they could watch from a distance, but they could not get close. And after a while, they got bored and went home.
What?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, a lot of that is like people just accepting authority.
Okay, so I have this theory, though, that as I've read some of this stuff and done research on this series of sightings, I'm running into a very common theme, and that is almost a matter-of-fact reporting of this, that, oh, yeah, there's something that's probably from another world. Oh, yeah, we saw these weird-looking humanoid things, probably from somewhere else. And I keep thinking to myself, why is this just so normal-sounding for people? And I've come to the conclusion that because people were quite a bit more isolated during this time, you know, newspapers were a big deal, there was communication, but it's nothing like we have now. So the idea of running into something that they'd never seen before was a much more normal thing then.
Well,
like, the idea of us running into something we've never seen before is far harder to come by because I've seen
everything.
Well, we've seen pictures of so much more and heard about so much more just because of the internet and television. Back then, people had seen and heard of far fewer things.
Sure.
I look at it kind of like your familiars report.
The one at patreon.com/Friday.
It's on Friday, yeah. Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies. Yeah. People were just ignorant and you just assumed, oh, huh, you know, that's fine. A wizard did it.
Well,
right. Well, I just think because there are reports of them seeing beings that look very different from humans, just accepting it as normal. And I think that the reason a lot of people could accept stuff like that as normal is because running into things they'd never seen before was much more common. You see what I mean, though?
Yeah,
does that
no,
make
I
sense?
Know,
that's
I know a good exactly argument. What it's you mean. Argument. I'm trying to like, I'm digging into the early literary history of science fiction.
Oh, don't worry. I'm getting to Jules Verne.
Okay.
We're covering Jules Verne, and we're going to talk about how that could have planted its some seeds.
It's just the idea that someone would assume something is a Martian is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, well.
And I'm sure you will get into it.
We will. You guys guess where else this thing showed up? Texarkana.
Of course.
Everything shows up there.
Something's wrong with that place.
It's kind of a cool place. This is one of my favorite stories. One farmer says he spoke with three crewmen who handed out hymnal pamphlets for Nearer My God to Thee.
Okay.
And told him that they were on their way to Greece.
Is there evidence that they were not?
I guess there's not.
Okay.
In Stephenville, Texas, early 1897 now, cigar-shaped craft with a pilot and engineer landed. It was seen by a dozen residents. There's a family in Merkel, Texas. They found an anchor attached to a fence, and the rope led to a cigar-shaped object. The craft cut the rope, left the anchor, and took off. The anchor was apparently on display for quite some time there.
This is like a Family Guy sketch.
Well, it's pretty interesting. You just keep waiting.
All right.
Okay, there was a railroad track inspector near Fort Worth. He'd been inspecting track for hours and hours. It was getting close to the end of the day. Daylight's fading. Suddenly, he sees this bright light ahead. head. Walks towards the bright light, finds a large silver cigar-shaped object sitting on the ground, surrounded by a crew in silver uniforms. They said that it was loaded with several tons of dynamite. They were going to use the dynamite to bomb the Spanish Navy. Again, context, guys, this was shortly before U.S. got involved in the Spanish-American War against Cuba.
I don't know that that's entirely accurate.
It is shortly before.
But it wasn't with Cuba, it was with Spain.
Right, but it was against Spanish Cuba.
Yes.
Because Cuba was occupied by Spain. Cuba was not an independent country at this point. So it was against Spanish Cuba.
Thanks for clearing that up, Kelly.
You're very welcome.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Cuba just kept coming up. Even in Arkansas, a former state senator by the name of Harris was told by a pilot of one of these airships that they were headed to Cuba and were going to use their Hotchkiss gun to kill Spaniards. Now, I definitely need a weapons authenticity report on what the hell a Hotchkiss gun is.
Sam's Weapons Authenticity Report.
Hotchkiss gun could have referred to any number of small and mid-sized cannons made by that company, possibly revolving-barreled cannons. Or
so it's like Civil War steampunk gunfire.
I don't know about any of those things.
Well, you know,
Sam, you know a lot about steampunk.
Well, you listeners can't see this, but I'm in full cosplay right now.
A lot of copper.
It's actually It's mostly plastic that I've spray-painted with Rust-Oleum metal effects.
Well,
hammered copper.
No one needs to know that.
No.
Early February, the thing shows up in Nebraska. The Omaha Bee reports it over a town called Hastings. So sightings are continuing throughout the Midwest at this point. Still sightings popping up over in California, some down in Texas. In Missouri, April 10th, a gentleman named W.H. Hopkins.
Everybody has two initials
in their last name. Right?
I actually put that on my return addresses, so I'm not judging.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's like your email address.
I mean, you have his public email address.
I mean, it is. Okay.
Yahoo.com.
He does love the Yahoo and the AOL. Fire. He actually has both of them.
Angelfire.com.
So Hopkins runs into a grounded airship. He says it's 20 feet long, 8 feet in diameter. Again, because it's a cylinder, so it's got a diameter, folks. It's on the outskirts of Springfield, Missouri. He claims it had three large propellers. Here we go, guys. A beautiful nude woman.
Oh, my God.
And a bearded man. Also nude. I do think that the beard is more important than the nude.
The woman was beautiful. The man, well, he was bearded.
Right. He tried to communicate with them, which apparently was very difficult.
Because he kept looking at her
boobs.
Well,
that could have been it. And then finally,
beard is up here.
Finally.
Well, this is 1897.
Finally, they point up to the sky and said something that Hopkins claims sounded like Mars. Struggle with that one, but
well,
hey, you know.
What, because someone said a word that we made up for a planet?
Yeah. April 11th finally hits its height. It's arrived in Chicago. People see it in Chicago. And on that day, apparently, a photo was snapped. And this is likely the first UFO photo in existence. I will definitely point out that in 1870, there was a photo taken, I believe, in New Hampshire that some people claim to be a UFO. However, debunkers have said that it's actually a cropped image of an elaborate frost formation. And because of that, if that 1870 photo is indeed bunk, this photo in 1897 becomes the first UFO photo ever taken.
It's interesting how slow everything would have to be going for there to be a photo taken of it.
I think that's very important to bring up.
That it takes so much light to develop a photo back.
I think that it's important to remember that, but we also have reports of these cigar-shaped ships traveling anywhere from 5 miles per hour to 200 miles per hour. Apparently, there's a great variation in the speeds that they're able to keep. So if it was moving super, 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 super slow, that could be why they were able to get a picture of it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it makes sense. But in order for there to have been one captured image, think about the volume of uncaptured sightings that would have happened. Because today, I mean, you get a lot of quote-unquote footage of UFOs, and we have cameras. Everyone has a camera, literally.
Oh, wow. That photo of the first UFO was actually sold for a whopping $385.
You're talking about the 1871, not the 1897 one. Here's the sad story about the 1897 photo, guys, in Chicago. At the time, newspapers weren't set up to publish photos. Still a pretty new medium. All they could do was publish drawings, so they actually drew a picture of the photo, which they then ran in the paper. Huh. And the photographer apparently sold several copies, but none of them survived. The negative at the time was given the acid test by the paper. They said it was genuine. But yeah.
Wait, what was the sad part? That they had to draw it?
That it's gone. We don't have the actual photo. All we have is the drawing of the photo.
Of the photo.
A little bit of a bummer. So we do have the photo from 1870, but people say that it's fake. That's a fake. I don't know.
Mount Washington, New Hampshire.
Doesn't it feel like it'd be really difficult to fake a photo in the 1870s, though, since it was really difficult to take a photo even?
Yes.
Anyhow, now April 16th, group of reliable, anonymous witnesses saw a ship overhead with many passengers, including a woman tied to a chair, a woman taking care of the woman tied to a chair, and a man guarding the prisoner with a gun. Go figure. Many more reports around Texas. April 15th to April 19th, there were 21 different towns in Texas that reported sightings in local newspapers. 9 more in the next 10 days. You guys ready for the first cattle mutilation abduction?
Of course, always ready.
April 19th, Alexander Hamilton, different one, he's a farmer, says a mysterious airship descends over his farm, abducts one of his cows with a rope.
It's very interesting that abilities of UFOs have progressed with startling speed.
Byron, I'm so glad you brought this up. I was watching a pretty cool documentary on this subject by Jim Mars, one of the foremost researchers on the JFK conspiracy. Actually, his book was the one that Oliver Stone based his movie on.
Sure.
And I did a lot of Jim Mars research when I was doing the JFK series, which we are going to do a revisitation. I've got a little bit more JFK stuff that I've come up with.
Fifth episode?
Yeah, we're going to do
like it.
He brings up this specific point, and apparently, I've never heard of this before, but there is something called cultural tracking theory, which is the theory that interdimensional or extraterrestrial travelers will specifically disguise themselves or use equipment that at least appears similar to the technology of the time so that they don't jump out of place by too much.
And that would explain the rope anchor that got left behind on the fence.
I mean, it's a nice explanation because it certainly makes it more difficult to disprove these things.
Well, no, it's not a real thing.
But who knows? When we look at this series of sightings from 1896 and 1897, we have a few possible explanations. One of them is there are a couple books by Jules Verne that had come out somewhat recently, Robur the Conqueror and its sequel, Master of the World. Both of those books had airships in them. So perhaps this had been planted in the social consciousness of people at the time. However, I don't know that those books were widely enough read. We were talking about literacy a little while ago. I don't know what the literacy rates were in the U.S. around this time, but the likelihood that everybody who saw these things had read those books would be pretty slim.
Well, not even literacy, just availability and access to that information. I mean, it wasn't like
both, right?
You know, a county library each county.
13.5% literate.
Okay, so it's hard to imagine that all the people that saw these were both literate and had read these books, because we've got a lot of variables working against that. The other thing that goes against the explanation of Jules Verne's influence is that there was a pioneer airship inventor named Arthur Constantine Krebs. He had worked quite a while in the 1800s on various airship designs. He was never wildly successful, but his work is even mentioned by Jules Verne in his books. You know, this was a thing that had been happening in the real world. Some people explain this as secret government weapons. So believe it or not, the explanation of unidentified flying objects being government conspiracies, that's gone on for a very long time. Part of that, of course, is because this theme of going to bomb the Cubans kept coming up over and over and over again. I guess bomb the Spanish Cubans.
Well, historically, though, aliens, extraterrestrials, and UFOs have tried to stop war.
Right, but that's why one of the explanations that people believed was going on at the time could have been, oh, this is government stuff. Like, they're actually military airships that are just a little bit further ahead technologically than we thought they would be by now. However, Sam, if I'm correct, a a floating steerable balloon would not be successfully utilized for almost another decade, right?
I don't believe that is the case.
So though there were airships that had flown previous to this, they were all very teeny tiny test missions and the capabilities of those ships were very, very limited in terms of performing any of the maneuvers or easy landings and quick takeoffs and the changes in altitude and especially the speed changes. None of that was even close to being demonstrated by airships at the time.
Well, even the Wright brothers' plane in 1903, it was still not easily maneuverable.
Right. The agility of this thing was pretty unique, based on my understanding of airships at the time. Obviously, my favorite theory is that this could have been extraterrestrials with cultural tracking, disguising themselves, or even sometimes not, because though the balloon shape certainly fits the equipment of the time, this true cigar shape, which is more of an image of what shows up in that 1870 picture, nothing that was being flown at this time by man looked like that. There were a couple lawyers for some reason who came out in the 1896, who came out and said, oh yeah, what you guys are seeing is built by my client, who is a genius inventor, and you're going to see this demonstrated during the day and blah, 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 blah. Well, that never came to be. The inventor never came forward. The lawyer retracted his statements, and then another one came out with similar statements, but it seemed to be publicity crap more than anything, because sure, nobody ever claimed the design for what was actually flying. There were some patents that were filed around those years for airship designs, but there's no record of them ever actually coming into existence, nor did anybody claim responsibility for actually being the person who built this ship. We do have some complications though, guys. Because on the one hand, we've got all this great evidence, tons and tons of newspaper articles, right? Tons of witnesses, a lot of people, even a couple true photos and some very beautiful drawings of those photos. But there was something going on around this time called yellow journalism, which means we have to be a bit more skeptical when consuming fake articles. News. Yeah, so before there was fake news, there was yellow journalism. Here's the Wikipedia definition, guys. Yellow journalism and the yellow press are American terms for journalism and associated newspapers that present little or no legitimate well-researched news, while instead using eye-catching headlines for increased sales. Techniques may include exaggerations of news events, scandal mongering, or sensationalism.
So this is like I was the editor of every paper in existence.
Well, and this was really happening.
Try to do it at Friday.com so we can get those clicks on me.
Hopefully you guys can foresee where I'm going with this, but as depicted in the movie Newsies, Pulitzer and Hearst were really at war during this time, and they were willing to publish any kind of nonsense necessary in order to sell papes. And those Newsies were working their butts off to sell those papes.
Did they really call them papes?
Papes.
Oh, God.
I would say that you have to be a child to enjoy it, but I saw it when I was a child, and I hated it.
Buy my papes.
Hated it.
Honestly, it's the little kid Newsies. I wish you knew it well enough to know what you were doing.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. And because of this, Pulitzer and Hearst are often seen as playing a very significant, if not even major, role in the U.S. entry into the Spanish-American War due to sensationalist stories or exaggerations of the terrible conditions in Cuba, which means the fact that these Cuban elements keep coming up in some of these reports, that kind of adds to like, okay, was this just one of Hearst and Pulitzer's shenanigans?
Everyone wants to read more about Cuba. So.
Right. So as with most things that I report on, you guys, I'm going to go ahead and say that a good chunk of what was seen was bunk. But I think that there was too much seen for it all to be bunk. If you sort through all of these different reports, in there are a few you really can't rule out with hoaxes or yellow journalism, misidentified stars, etc. So here we are back in Aurora, and we need to determine whether what happened in Aurora falls into one of those categories of hoax or yellow journalism, or whether this was one of the real things that was possibly going on and as of yet unexplained at the time. And I was able, through research and through some of the stuff that Jim Mars presented, to come to the conclusion that I think it had some legitimacy to it. There are people in the town, obviously all the eyewitnesses of this event, since it occurred in the late 1800s, are now dead. However, there was research that happened in the 1970s when some newspapers in Texas began to dig a little bit more into what was going on. And Jim Mars was actually involved himself in that research because he was a journalist for a Texas newspaper. I think he was their aerospace writer or something like that at the time. He went on site and he and another reporter from a separate newspaper did some investigation. They talked to people who truly said they had seen this, people who swore up one side and down the other that this was a real thing that happened. According to the old timers, tons of people went rushing up to the crash site, but they made all the kids stay back underneath the hill because they were really afraid that whatever crashed might have a disease that the kids would be vulnerable to.
I mean, that's not my first instinct, but I guess.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, we're not that far off from horrible diseases ravaging things. Yeah. Not a lot of understanding of the way diseases work. And of course, you guys, this story of the body becomes central to the veracity, or at least the intrigue, of the Aurora crash. Now, here's the cemetery, a standard old-timey cemetery. We've got some Civil War folks buried there. We've got, you know, I think that the cemetery was founded in 1860, if I remember correctly. And this grave obviously would have been from 1897. So the grave is near a large oak tree. It has a really crude rock headstone that appears to be broken off. In 1873, when Jim Mars first started investigating this, it looked like there was almost a drawing of the UFO that the creature may have crashed in. He and the other reporter used a metal detector, indicated that at least three large pieces of metal were buried by this headstone. One right near the headstone and two others near the center of the grave. So they decided that they were going to try and get the metal out of the grave. So,
wait, why? weird thing to do.
Well, because they wanted to see what the hell was down there. Because
There's a lot of things in a graveyard that I'm like, hey, I wonder what's in there.
Well, we know that this is... No. Don't...
Well, you just have to look at it as
this is a fucking place where an alien is supposed to be buried. The townspeople say that there is an alien buried
here. Yeah, they're going to go steal his fillings.
But if you're wrong, you're digging in a graveyard.
Okay, well, obviously they didn't dig.
People
they
went dig to go in graveyards all the time.
No, I'm just
they
saying.
Went to go get permission to dig.
Okay.
And oddly, though, according to town records, that's exactly what's buried there is this pilot of the airship that was not of this world.
Uh-huh. That was given a Christian burial.
That was given a Christian burial, which he may have found very offensive.
Very.
They won't let him dig. And I find this to be really freaking strange. Why in the world would they keep somebody from digging it up? Especially because it's not like he was going to be disturbing a bunch of other graves by digging it. It's not like this is a big fancy pants graveyard. I mean, in all honesty, it's kind of
like a
Potter's Field.
It looks rough.
Yeah, it's just not.
Yeah, but who's going to complain?
Well, I mean, maybe.
I don't know. If I was some sort of cemetery man, someone guarding the final resting place for people, I don't think, even if I didn't know someone, that we should dig their body back
well,
up.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I were
an alien?
If I were Jim Myers, I would have just freaking done it.
Ask for forgiveness?
Yeah.
Other than permission?
That's always my philosophy when I dig in graveyards.
Well, they say that it's supposed to be an alien. Another interesting thing, though, you guys, according to the townspeople who were alive at the time, the wreckage, the debris from this ship, was thrown into the well on Proctor's property and then covered up. Okay.
I mean, they're doing some weird.
But the person,
Mel's Hole thing.
Yeah, but the person who lived there ended up developing some super horrific and severe form of arthritis, and later on did open up the well after it had been sealed for years and years and years. They did some tests on the metal, and the test came back inconclusive.
Which means that they don't know what it was, but they don't know what it wasn't.
One of the statements made in the 1970s when the two Texas reporters did some investigation into the story, Miss Peguis, not sure how you pronounce her name, but she lived in the area at the time, and she said that Judge Proctor never even had a windmill on his property. Well, it turns out that that was incorrect, because when UFO hunters went in 2008 to the site of the crash, and the current owner, his name's Tim Oates, there was indeed the remains of a windmill and water tower. It was apparently kind of like a combination unit that Proctor had up. So this woman who had naysayed everything was mistaken, and Judge Proctor did have a windmill on his property, and something did knock it down. Whether that was some craft that was being tested by an inventor and failing,
sure,
or some military type deal, or an alien, I don't know, but I think without any question, there was something in Aurora, and this grave held the keys. I'm digging through this information. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. There's a body here. Why? I haven't heard about this.
Through.
It's true.
Exhuming, if you will.
Well, this is pretty strange, guys. December 2nd, 2005, UFO Files first aired an episode related to this incident. They called it the Texas Roswell. Yeah, no big surprise there. It's a catchy title.
Obvious, yeah.
This episode talked about the investigation in 1973, which was where Bill Case from the Dallas Times Herald and Jim Myers began investigating things. MUFON dug up a couple new eyewitnesses. Mary Evans, who was 15 at the time, said that her parents went to the crash site, but they forbade her from going. She also discussed the discovery of the alien body. Charlie Stevens, who was 10 at the time, said that he saw the airship trailing smoke as it headed north toward Aurora. He wanted to see what happened, but his father made him finish his chores, and then later he told how his father went down the next day to see the wreckage from the crash.
Now, before you go see the dead body of an alien,
you
just
finish your chores. You live on a farm. You really do. Everything shuts down if you don't do all that stuff.
And, I mean, honestly, if you're not there with hedge clippers to sever the rope of a UFO from lassoing your cattle.
It's true.
You know.
MUFON investigated the Aurora Cemetery, and they uncovered the same grave marker that Jim Myers and Bill Case had described. It appeared to show a flying saucer of some sort. They also got readings from the metal detector, so they wanted to exhume the site. Again, got denied. After the MUFON investigation, this is where it gets really interesting, guys. The marker mysteriously disappears from the cemetery. It's replaced by a 3-inch pipe. MUFON took the metal detector back, and now suddenly the metal detector readings are no longer there.
So
somebody already stole the fillings.
Wow.
Really interesting, huh?
I mean,
if MUFON can't figure it out, I mean, it could be anything. Like an alien. It could be aliens.
Yeah.
We're going to get a bunch of shovels. We're going to go dig up every
grave. No, we aren't going to dig up anything. However, if there are any listeners in the area surrounding Aurora, Texas, I would love to hear if you visited this grave site, if you've heard anything about it, if you have any friends who had great-great-grandparents and stories have been passed down through generations. I love all that stuff. It'd be wonderful to hear from any of you. But I am going to go ahead and say that Captain Kelly, on record, believes something significant happened at Aurora, Texas in 1897. It was not a situation of yellow journalism as some of the other airships of 1896 may have been. This was a big deal, guys. This is an origin point. Hoping that more information comes out and maybe someday we can dig up that grave, although it sounds like whatever was once there is gone, and I bet it's in the cigarette-smoking man's basement.
Oh, my God. All right. Thank you so much for that report, Kelly.
Thank you, guys. Hey, you guys, I really hope you enjoyed this movie since I didn't get to see it.
Well, I'm sure you'll catch up.
I'm going to see it.
Yeah, so you will not be joining Sam and I in our discussion of A Quiet Place.
No, I won't. I will be in Berkeley, California at a Vipassana retreat.
Mm-hmm. So it would just be Byron and I talking about A Quiet Place.
Right now, after this break.
We hope you're enjoying your visit here this evening. Now, on with the show.
A Quiet Place is a 2018 American horror film directed by Jim, starring his wife Pam. Not really. No.
Byron.
No, I'm sorry. John Krasinski.
Leslie Knope. It's Leslie Knope.
God. Alongside Emily Blunt, his real-life spouse, of course. Sam, can you tell me a little bit about this movie?
A family fights for survival in a world decimated by creatures who hunt by sound.
Pretty good. We got creatures. That's about as far as I'm going to go before we lay down the spoiler warning, I
guess.
Want,
I can roll that back.
No, too. You're fine. I think that's fine. We know there's creatures. There's big claw marks in the walls.
Yeah,
in the
exactly.
I know. Okay. Well, maybe you haven't seen the trailer, but if you got this far and didn't push pause, you got to give us a break here.
Come on, guys.
But from here on out, maybe we should lay down a blanket spoiler warning because, I mean, the way they marketed this film, it was completely open.
Yep.
We know you got to be quiet. You got to walk on sand. You got to be Jim.
Do things blow up if you're loud? Like, what happens?
I don't know. Yell, and people are always knocking over stuff during board games. That's all I know. I guess it's time for a kind of dead giveaways. This is the point in the show where we potentially spoil parts of a movie. I'm going to try not to ruin it for you, but if you're one of those people who wants to go in completely blind, and I don't blame you, people like Kelly, you did the same thing, right?
I saw the trailer, and that was it. Yeah.
All right. Think about, consider, use your brain, press pause, and of course, come back. It's in a theater. Go watch it. Creatures.
They were from Resident Evil.
You think of Resident Evil? It's
the
funny.
Movies.
Not the games. Were there
Correct.
Aliens in Resident Evil?
No, mutants. They're mutants.
That's true.
But that's what they were. I mean, they looked like that.
Visually pretty intense.
Yeah.
Angry.
Oh, super aggro.
Do not like...
Just always clawing at stuff and smashing things.
They hate sound. Some kind of interesting things that put this into motion. We come into a world, we have no idea where it started.
Day 89.
Was it 89?
I think that's what it was.
I think you saw it just now.
I did.
I saw it at South by Southwest, which was a very interesting experience. And for those Patreon patrons, you got the Q&A from the world premiere available to you. I know that I just talked to...
Was Michael Bay there?
He was not there. It was just John and Emily Blunt. And then the kids were there too, which was actually pretty great. That girl is deaf. She had an interpreter that was doing all the talking for her. Pretty incredible actress. And I think she's going to do a lot of great stuff.
Yeah. The kids, I think, were exceptional.
I liked Emily Blunt too. And there's a specific scene that I want to talk about a little bit later.
Yeah.
Further along, dig in.
She was honestly a completely plausible prairie woman, badass.
Sure.
In this movie. She was holding the whole thing together.
Krasinski, man.
Yeah.
Day 80, whatever. We don't know what happened, why these aliens are here. But for some reason, we're kicked off with this kind of significant moment that I think I became a little bit frustrated with this movie. An action happens, something that you would think that people would know better about at this point, and a tragedy happens. Are we on the same page?
Yeah. yeah, this horrible tragedy befalls this family of...
But it's potentially unnecessary, right? Yes. Or like there could have been a little bit more inventive way to get there.
I think it was...
Toys make noise.
They do. Don't play with them in this world.
Especially if they have batteries.
Yeah.
Let's take the batteries out.
I thought those batteries were going to roll off the table and that was going to be what...
Could have very well been, yeah.
I think it's important because, I mean, it's another example of what this family is dealing with mm-hmm. as they go forward in addition to, like, just the tragedies that they endure and then soldier on.
You know, I think they do learn a little bit more following that experience. But for a family that talks all the time with sign language because they have a deaf daughter, which is very convenient in this sort of end of world situation.
Yeah.
Like I said, a little bit frustrated with the kickoff to this movie. Mm-hmm. It left kind of an odd taste in my mouth, but it doesn't take away from the brutal nature of what is, turns out, a PG-13 film. They find a way to, I guess, with aggressive sound, startle me.
Oh, just hit you in the face with it.
Oh, a majority of this film is silent. Not silent. Dialogue
extremely
is...
extremely muted with no dialogue.
Yeah, dialogue is, for the most part, a subtitled sign language.
Yeah.
And there's some sort of like lip reading stuff. And a lot of Krasinski doing a shh. Did you see how he did the shush?
He always curved his finger. Okay, or like, was it broken? It's like he was sniffing his finger.
I'm so happy you noticed that too. The person I was at South by Southwest with, we, for the rest of the festival, because this was the opening night movie, we'd look at each other and do the Krasinski shush, which is like
a sniff.
His finger's just way too far up, hooked around on the side of his nose for some reason. And it's like he doesn't know how to shush.
This
is important to me.
It is. I understand.
Okay, good.
But talking about joking about the boring days that we don't get to see.
Sure.
I kind of would like to see how some of this infrastructure that they're relying on happened. I mean, all the lights that they have strung everywhere and the paths of sand.
Amazing,
I mean,
like, set piece. Well, yeah.
Ooh, who put those? I mean, that's a nightmare. I've moved a lot of sand around.
You have.
It sucks.
You've got a sand mover's body.
Yeah, I have a sandbag's body.
Okay. You mentioned the lights. This is a set piece that I think is probably one of my favorite visuals in this movie.
Yep.
It's a system of party lights.
Yeah, the little,
I don't know,
like the ones you run around.
Nice people's backyard lights.
And
wedding
lights. Yeah, the strings of them, the white ones.
And Krasinski's got a system. Sure. I don't know if I've seen that one. Is that Matt Damon?
I had to watch it. Oh, it's Brad Pitt. Boy, I don't know.
You know, they're all kind of the same. Do you see Ben Affleck's back tattoos?
Oh.
Got a large phoenix. It's very funny. The lights. And I bet I sound a lot less sick than I did about 15 minutes ago, by the way. So that's pretty incredible. We should maybe say that we took a little break between recording the last part of the show and we are now talking
about
it.
There is some fancy editing that went into bringing you this portion of the show.
Sure. So I...
And it's been partially, you can't hear it because Byron actually has taken her out.
Uh-huh.
But Kelly is engaging in this conversation as well.
Oh, of course. I'm just muting her repeatedly and it is very difficult for me. But I hope wherever she is in reality, she's having a great time. Maybe she's listening to us talk about this movie. She probably won't though.
No, she will.
Well, I hope that she goes. Is she going to see it?
She's going to.
Oh, and she's going to give us a score at
but
some
she
point.
Specifically said I'm gonna listen to the movie anyway.
Oh well, you know, I
or
don't
I'm gonna listen to the podcast anyway. What do we do?
Podcast about the movie.
Podcast about the movie.
Yeah, you got it. I don't think that it's going to ruin the movie to know what it's about though. And the way that the marketing kind of was advertised,
it was
which
a
is
coy.
How marketing works.
Uh-huh.
I think that it was unnecessarily coy.
It's at its core, it's just a straightforward monster movie.
It's Signs, but a little bit louder.
Yeah. And maybe Walking Dead.
And quieter as well. But these lights, when something bad happens, all the lights that are strung pretty much everywhere, it's a farmhouse they're at.
Yeah.
Down the cornfields, they flip a switch and it goes from white lights to red lights, which is such a cool like visual switch of tension. You
Especially
know?
Not to take anything away from the excellent CG in this movie, but it was mm-hmm. CG. This is a really cool practical set work.
It was ILM. Industrial Light and Magic. So.
Oh, that explains it.
Yeah?
The
quality? I can't tell if you're liking it or not.
No, it was CG, but the quality of the CG was excellent.
The creature
design. Absolutely top notch.
Yeah, almost distractingly so for the, I guess the, well, I don't want to be too mean, quality of the film.
Yeah.
But it's so tough.
You didn't need to see him that much.
I agree. You see a lot of these loud and hideous monsters, set pieces. I don't want to dig too deep into what happens after that, but there's a moment where Emily Blunt goes through hell.
Yeah.
One of the tougher scenes I've had to see someone be put through this year. It's still pretty early.
It's not, it's not a spoiler to say, why would you, I mean, you as a couple.
Listen to Neil.
Listen to Neil Young.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely. Harvest Moon. That whiny son of a bitch.
Oh.
God, I hate Neil Young.
But you know what happens after you listen to Neil Young?
Yeah.
You copulate.
Or you just smash things because you hate Neil Young so much.
Well, but what happened in this case is they are trying to bring another life into this world, which to me seems logistically very...
complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because babies cry.
They cry?
Uh-huh.
You gotta feed them? Although that didn't seem like a problem. They were pretty well set up with provisions.
Yeah, I thought so too.
But just, what do you... Like, why would you do that to a kid?
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. And the interesting thing, and they go into this a little bit in the Q&A for Patreon patrons.
I am not a Patreon patron, so no. I did not get to listen to that.
You don't get to understand what their names were. There's no names in this movie.
Nope.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah. So we're not just Kelly saying that guy and that lady and the girl.
No names. Emily Blunt becomes pregnant, and then she starts the birthing process at a point that is inconvenient.
Yes. She is just gritting her teeth and being a badass.
I mean, in the face of some serious Home Alone action.
I never thought about it like that, but yeah.
Yeah.
That was silly.
You know what was sillier, though?
Huh.
Oh, God. And this is also maybe what kind of f***ed my experience a little bit. The audience for the premiere of this film, well, let me say it this way. Did your audience find things extremely humorous?
My audience was the best audience I have ever sat. They were just dead silent the whole time, and I was terrified because there were high school kids, and it's a quiet movie.
Yeah, it's a quiet place.
I was very, very worried.
Mm-hmm. But no laughing?
No, none. Not a chuckle, not a chortle, not a smirk.
For some reason, there is two scenes that I can think of off the top of my head. One is the second time they enter into the basement after there's something wrong with the stairs that is harmful for you. I'm being very coy as well. Like the
when the kids walk by and
when the last girl comes by. Did you think that maybe that was going to happen?
I was like, that's.
They were laughing like as if it was like this, like oh, is she gonna? Whoop. And it was just like very strange tonally. I just don't think the audience at South by Southwest quite understood it, mostly because I think a majority of the audience was there because of John Krasinski, which is also a reason I think a lot of people are going to turn out for this movie, period.
Yeah, and Michael Bay.
And the Bay Man. Second thing involves a crate and oxygen tank.
Yes.
Did you find that funny?
As a parent...
Uh-huh. First, second time you've ever said that in your life. How's it feel?
It's fine.
Right.
Extremely... That was probably the most affecting part of the whole movie for me.
Well, I mean, not
like just imagining myself in that scenario.
Uh-huh. The fact that you had to think about that.
Yeah.
Like, plan for that.
Yes.
And that's an incredible, I thought, effective moment. Yes. They thought that was hilarious. I really shouldn't blame the audience for my thoughts in this film now. Maybe I should have went with you today, because to me, that was just so frustrating. I could see what they were doing, and I could not see how that was funny. But
there were definitely parts of this movie that they thought through, I think, better than they did in some other points.
Sure.
And this was one of them, you know, a possibly real-world solution to a nightmare problem. I don't mean a child is a nightmare problem.
No, but... bringing a child, much like in a zombie apocalypse. It's the same kind of thing. Like, you know, it happens and you can be happy about it, but you should be dreading having to bring someone into such a conflicted world.
Also, I'm not buying that we lost to these weirdos.
Especially since, turns out, this is another step in the spoiler direction. There's not that many of them.
Speaking of spoilers, there is no dialogue. Which isn't true, because like you said, there's a lot of subtitled sign language, but things are really shoved in your face, written on whiteboards and clippings, newspaper clippings, just real obvious, real amateurish, heavy-handed.
I noticed the same thing.
And I think it would have been, honestly, more effective to let people figure these things out. You know, we don't need to know how many of these things there are. I imagine that this family was thrust completely unprepared into this world, and it may have been better if we had been the same.
I completely agree. And I know the scene you're thinking of opening up into whatever Krasinski's world is, a point where I almost did think that was kind of funny. It just felt weird for something that was so subtle in its marketing and in the majority of the moments. This was just like...
Dateline, upstate New York, the aliens have landed.
Exactly.
They're moving across the fields now.
Legit red string, basically.
Yeah.
Tying things in big letters.
We're not that stupid.
Yeah,
and it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. But I mean, we're complaining about a Paramount picture, PG-13, produced by Michael Bay. So maybe not necessarily for us, but... I gotta say, not disappointed with it.
No, me neither. And once I found out that this was John Krasinski, mm-hmm. I deliberately didn't learn anything more about it because that had already turned my nose up a little bit and I didn't want to do anything more. I wanted to go in as, you know, untainted as possible. And I think I'm glad I did that. Full disclosure, like, I think he's probably a great guy. I love him in The Office, but it's just, I don't think that he gets horror. I mean, he's not a horror weirdo.
No, he even said that in our little Q&A. He said, I don't like dabbling. Scary movies. I think oftentimes major production companies will lean on horror because they know that opening week, it's going to fill seats, no matter what.
And you can make it for cheap.
You very much can. I don't know.
Or you can drag Industrial Light thing? Magic into it, and then you're not cheap anymore.
And then you're making some, like,
hey, what are you guys doing between Star Wars movies? Oh, you want to do this little independent horror? I mean, you know, maybe it's not independent.
I mean, it'll be cool. Krasinski's there. $17 million budget. You know, that's pretty
small. It's reasonable.
It's pretty small for something like this. How much does sand cost?
Sand is really cheap.
Okay.
But you got to get somebody to put all that sand out there.
That's true. And it's not Krasinski, even though he's ripped from all those action movies he's been doing.
Yeah.
You know.
Which is not plausible also.
To do all those action movies and still make a good horror film.
So what do you think he was in his previous life?
Well, I have
I have
a description of what he was.
So I'm going to guess.
Yeah, hit me with
it. I'm guessing he was military,
mm-hmm.
possibly... Probably special forces,
okay.
Maybe a Navy SEAL.
Well, it doesn't go into super detail, but it says that he is a survivalist. I don't know who focuses on getting his family through. So maybe that's something he came through afterwards, I guess. But everyone following a post-apocalyptic event is a survivalist. You kind of get that title, right?
Yeah.
If you're still alive.
You have to be.
You're trying to survive.
It's not like, yeah, you're that crazy person that's stockpiling food in the grain silo. Like, you're the guy that's alive when everyone else is dead.
Speaking of grain silos, is that how grain silos work?
Yes.
Why?
Why
do you just like kind of, are you heavier than the grains so that?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I don't understand the physics of it, but absolutely.
I was very.
Like, that's a thing in a farming community.
You'd it's
like
die and then they find you next spring.
And it's the best year, best year for wheat they ever had.
Well, that's a.
The wheat was tasty.
It's like an offering.
It had body.
Style. Well, maybe that is a sacrifice that sometimes happens.
The only thing that I was basing my, other than like he's obviously a survivalist, but when he was going through it, there was a point where he was going through a chest of belongings that had been obviously his in a previous life. He had a watch that is available to the general public, but would be something that, you know,
it's also in the Marlboro catalog.
It's in the Marlboro catalog.
Okay. Yeah.
It's right behind the jacket.
Oh, cool. That is interesting. I'm trying to read more things here about the characters. We didn't say much about Noah Jupe, who plays the son. He's great.
He is.
Really great. A little less meant for that world.
A little timid. Not quite the intrepid, utilitarian person that his dad is and his mother.
Sure. But, I mean, yeah, I don't want to ruin too many more of these fun set pieces. I think A Quiet Place is a very dynamic film that startled me with sound and visuals.
Yeah, lots of jump scares.
But not too cheap.
No.
I don't think Krasinski was in charge of the scares.
It's probably in post.
Yeah.
What do you think about the pacing?
Oh, it's been long enough, and I was probably frustrated throughout. Oh, God, it's so hard to...
It was uneven.
Like, following inciting incident, character building, then to whatever the, I guess, massive...
Just a lot of starts and stops,
sure.
It felt like.
Starts and stops that resulted in kind of a repeated action.
Generally speaking, they were isolated incidents that weren't... Which I guess, you know, maybe that's... how they're supposed to be, but you like to, I mean, I think generally we like to see something building, you know, to the climax.
Kind of like a Jurassic Park raptor buildup.
Yeah.
I think that's like one of the better ones that comes to mind.
That's a really good point. Yeah, very much so.
It crescendos, it releases, but it doesn't release long enough to reset.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really cool that this was done with sign language. It's a really interesting selling point. The monster is really cool, not unique for unique's sake. Showed a little bit too much of it, but it did look good. Krasinski, I respect him. I think he does great work generally. Maybe he should follow his gut and stay out of the genre. I hope that this is a great jumping off point for him as a director. Emily Blunt, I love everything she does. She's one of the best actresses out there right now. These kids are going to do great stuff. I don't think it's a funny movie, so I guess let me know if your audience laughs along. I don't know how on earth.
Dump a soda on them. Just throw that 64 ounce straight across the theater at whoever laughs.
I give this a Let's just go seven even for a lot of reasons.
Seven what, Byron?
Well, I said seven even for a lot of reasons, and that's kind of fun, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I guess I could say seven red light bulbs. That's fun. Okay.
Yeah, it is. This is hyped to be something like The Witch or It Follows, like some genre redefining, independent, something that really gets under your skin. Uh-huh. And it's not. It's a monster movie. And it's a monster movie that's made by someone who doesn't really understand monster movies. And that's really evident, even if you didn't know Krasinski's previous work.
Working at the camera.
Yeah, exactly. This does not work.
Well, let's give him credit. He invented it.
That being said, it was fun despite uneven pacing and too much of the very good monsters. So I give A Quiet Place 6.5 smoked fish.
And those are our thoughts on A Quiet Place. Of course, one voice has been missing. I hope that at some point very soon we'll get Kelly's opinion on this because I'm quite curious. I'm also quite curious to know what you thought of this movie, which, of course, is available in theaters, I guess technically yesterday, but I mean, this is going out the official day of release, so go to the theater, let us know what you thought about this, tweet us at Fright Day on Twitter, let's talk about it in the Facebook group, facebook.com/group/FrightDay.
Or FrightDay.club.
Great alternative to the same thing. Or you leave a comment below this episode in the show notes at FrightDay.com, which is a great place. We have been dropping articles like crazy.
I know. Our writers are pretty spectacular.
Oh, they're all right.
And they're fine. Don't get big heads, guys.
And I know you're listening, guys. Not going to be specific because there's too many of you.
Guys and ladies.
And ladies, mostly, honestly. Let's be real.
Yeah.
And if you like this show and want to help us make it even better, of course, you can grab something spooky at shop.frightday.com. Something we have yet to talk about on the show is a little idea that just kind of came out of nowhere during an episode 2 or 1 ago. The Stringboard Starter Kit is an actual thing.
Really cool.
We made,
because Byron makes cool things.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. We made 50 of these limited edition hand numbered string board starter kits, which include red yarn, a very special map they drew up that is covered with Fright Day related points.
Tagged to their geographic locations in the U.S.
I did my best.
It's a great map.
Is it good?
It is
well,
good.
Thank you.
Mel's Hole, come on.
Of course. I did try to find Mel's Hole. Very
Ellensburg, Washington.
It's very hard to find, honestly.
I know. I've actually, I think we talked about this. I've lined up Terra Server images with Google Earth and used...
It's a pain.
Used topographical overlays to... Yep.
Yeah,
no,
so
it is.
You're a loser, huh? All right. And a bunch of pins to get you started. Sticky notes. Everything.
Don't eat the pins.
No, please don't.
Sticky notes, that's... You know,
oh, man, they're
you,
sharp.
You
I forgot. Maybe I should have put a warning on the bag. But don't hurt yourself. It's pretty much everything you need. If you're a conspiracy theorist, if you're a serial killer hunter.
You're just trying to connect the dots between random occurrences in the U.S.
Fantastic. It's great for all those things. There were 5 limited edition, ultra limited, I guess, photocopied versions. They're all gone. So I want to say, like, they were gone the first day, which is incredible.
Nice.
You guys are super amazing. I hope you enjoy those. shop.frightday.com. Lots of other great things. The reflective shirt's on sale because I love you guys.
We talked about how much I love shiny things.
Uh-huh. And don't get lost out there. It's gloomy, rainy, and if you're outside, make sure you're seen. We just care about you guys.
You want to give yourself every possible advantage in the civil suit once you're run over jogging at midnight on the side of a road in the bad part of town, Byron?
Yes, I have a bad habit of... I don't know. And if this show isn't enough for you, if you find yourself craving more Kelly after this Kelly-free portion of the show here, patreon.com/frightday is a thing, and it's a thing you may be interested in. There are 17, soon to be 18 episodes of Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies available. Spoiler alert.
That makes me feel so old.
Yeah, I know. We've been doing this for a while. Episode 18 involves something we're going to be talking about next week as well.
Oh, I can't wait. What is it?
We're talking Piawackit next week.
Okay.
Which is a fun little witchy film.
Oh, I remember it.
Okay,
I remember it in the future.
All right, because we definitely didn't already record that episode. Yeah, lots of other things at patreon.com/frightday. Sam, what's your favorite?
I like Kelly's moose recipe.
Oh, God. Are you just trying to make her smile because she's not here and she's listening?
I'm so clearly just kidding.
You already know it by heart.
I do. It's got chocolate and some other stuff in it.
Okay, weird.
The live stream that we do.
Oh, yeah. Next one's coming up in 2 or 3 weeks.
Where we have a chance to talk to you guys and bounce whatever you want off of us. and it's great. It's great to get to know you a little bit. There's, let's see, what else is on there, Byron?
I don't know. Kelly made playlists. You make playlists. I think I'm going to post my playlist up there too.
Oh, good.
Just, it's just another way that you can connect with us.
Oh, Cinema Autopsy.
Oh, yeah, which is an exploration into some of the best films.
Where we offer amateur commentary in lieu of the readily available director's commentary on movies.
And, of course, you guys voted The Hills Have Eyes, 1977 or 8. It is the next film. And then I guess we're doing, what is it? 2001 A Space Odyssey?
No, God,
I think
no.
Kelly said something weird like that. So that'll be really boring.
Oh, but yeah, listen to us talk for 3 hours about AI.
Before things get boring, check it out. Also, I mean, honestly, I don't think we say this enough when we talk about Patreon. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's humbling. It's too much. But thank you and keep it coming. No, but honestly, it really puts things in perspective for us because we know that money is not easy to come by. And for you to give it to us, well, you know, don't we feel obligated to not make garbage?
It's true. We are forced to create worthy content. So thanks a lot for doing that for all the other listeners that don't. It really does mean a lot.
You guys we love as well, but just, you know.
A little less. Yeah. Most helpful of all, leave a review on iTunes. Of course, that's the best way to get us inside of ears, up side of charts. Piwacket next week and the beginning of a series about a very wicked person. So, Kelly, you'll be back even though she won't be back in reality. What is this world?
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
It feels like a fiction podcast.
Yeah, it very much does. Sam, where can we find you on the internet?
I am at Sam Frightday. Email me, sam@frightday.com. On Instagram, sam_MiloDragovich.
And I'm at Byron McCoy on Twitter and Instagram. Byron@frightday.com is my email address. Tweet at Kelly Frightday. Tell her you want to hear her thoughts about this movie because I really don't want her to forget. And until next Friday, I'm Byron.
And I'm Sam.
Stay quiet.